Hi everyone, you're listening to Geek of Oz Presents Read, Watch, Play, the official podcast of geekofoz.com. I'm Chris, I'm in a bunker in the Commonwealth because I've been playing too much Fallout 4 still, and I don't even know what reality is anymore. Can someone please help? It's becoming a problem. Yes, immersion, woo. Just a quick update on some posts that have hit the site recently before the super mutants kicked my door down. We've got trailer posts for the new Ghostbusters and Captain America Civil War trailers. We've got Stu's review of the excellent Son of Saul, which won Best Foreign Film at the Golden Globes recently. We've got Christoph's 75 Years of Captain America celebratory post. We've got my review of Simon Warden's novel Down Station and an in-progress review of Dark Souls 3. So go check those out at www.geekofoz.com. Now, the following Read, Watch, Play episode is not your typical episode. It's actually an interview I was lucky enough to conduct with the treasured Australian fantasy author Leanne Hearn. Leanne is most well known for her series Tales of the Otori, which is a feudal Japan-inspired fantasy series. Kind of evokes a bit of a mashup of some elements of Star Wars, a little bit of Memoirs of a Geisha, a little bit of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. A lot of wonderful evocations in this series, and Leanne has recently released the first book of the prequel, The Tale of Shikanoko, which is set 300 years before Otori. The first book is Emperor of the Eight Islands, and so to celebrate the launch, I got to sit down with Leanne on this past Wednesday, March 9th, which was coincidentally the release date of the book, and we talked about the book itself, we talked about Tales of the Otori, we talked about Leanne's influences and what prompts her to write, and we talked about, you know, what kind of characters from her books she'd like to most have her cup of tea with. It was a really fantastic discussion. I'd just like to once again thank Leanne for her time, graciously giving her time that morning, and thank you to the Hachette people who helped set it all up, specifically Jordan Weaver-Keeney, who's one of the publicists at Hachette who helped get the ball rolling on this. So, without further ado, please enjoy this interview with Leanne Hearn, and go check out Emperor of the Eight Islands. It's available in bookstores now.
You are listening to Geek of Oz Presents Read, Watch, Play. We discuss all things pop culture, including comics, video games, TV, film, and anime.
Okay, this is Chris for Geek of Oz's Read, Watch, Play podcast, and I'm sitting down with author Leanne Hearn, who today is celebrating the launch of her new book, Emperor of the Eight Islands, the first book of the Tale of Shikanoko. First of all, Leanne, good morning, and thank you for sitting down with us today.
Oh, thanks very much for inviting me.
Yeah, how are you feeling about the release of your book today? It must be a big relief having it out and for people to check out.
Well, it's always very exciting, but it's also slightly nerve-wracking too, because at the moment so few people have read it that it's hard to know what they're going to think of it, or, you know, how it will be received or whatever. So, and there's also a strange stage in between finishing a book and when you see it published, that you're sort of adrift, you know, in a limbo, waiting to see what will happen, wondering if it is really finished, thinking of things that you could have done better and so on. But overall, it's exciting.
Oh, fantastic. Mm. So can you give us just a brief idea of what Emperor of the Eight Islands is about?
That's kind of hard because it's a very complex plot.
It really is.
I posted an Instagram picture of a vine tightly entwined round a tree a few months ago and said, this is what my plot looks like because it's so tight. Even I couldn't unravel it. Basically, it's the story of the main character, Shikanoko, which means the deer's child, who is the son of a warrior family who is taken in by a mountain sorcerer and given a mask that's for him alone from the skull of a stag. And then in the background there's a conflict going on between two great rival clans for control of the Eight Islands and who will be the emperor. So the son of the crown prince, who is killed in fighting, the son is a six-year-old boy, no, even younger than six, escapes with his foster sister and they flee. But he is always the true emperor. So one of the themes of the story is that while the emperor is not the right emperor, things can't be in harmony, and so heaven and earth are out of harmony, and there are all sorts of natural disasters, floods and droughts and so on, typhoons. Anyway, that's one thread of the story, and then the other threads include the birth of the five children from cocoons. They have five fathers, and they are hatched out of cocoons like spiders, and they grow up with certain supernatural powers that readers of the Otori will recognize.
Definitely.
So that's another thread of it. And then there's the sort of warrior family thread of one of my favorite characters is Lady Tama, who was taken from her first husband and forced to marry his older brother. And this throws up a kind of rupture in the harmony of the world that has immense repercussions all through the story. And that actually happened fairly often in medieval Japan, that women, you know, would be married off to one warlord by their fathers or their older brothers, and they would settle down happily with them and make a fist of it, and then they'd be ordered to leave him and go marry somebody else.
Oh, wow.
All for the sake of, you know, politics and power. And there isn't very, very much written about how the women actually felt about that, but it had always stayed in my mind as a fascinating subject as to how you would feel and how you would react in a male-dominated society where you were supposed to be obedient to your father and your husband and so on. So,
You've definitely got a strength in this book for female characters, as it with the Tales of the Otori, with taking the interesting perspective on how the female characters react to the how the male characters sort of run the world and how they, in a lot of cases, mess things up.
Yes.
For everybody.
It's always interesting to look at the side of history that isn't actually written much about and to try to imagine how those people felt about it, because of course they had an equally rich life with all of the emotions, and they also had influence over husbands and fathers through affection, you know, as we do now. Mm. So it's kind of a mistake to think of it as entirely male-dominated without women having any means of power at all. But it's just that it's that male side that is recorded, and so that's what we read most about.
Mm. This is very different to a lot of those other fantasy novels.
So it's all a, you know, sort of effort of the imagination by reading between the lines in history and looking at a lot of art and poetry and so on, and working out how the women might have been feeling.
Nice. So what was the original inspiration for The Tale of Shikanoko? Because it's the prequel to the Tales of the Otori series, which is probably one of your most beloved works.
Yes, it's a sort of prequel. I guess one of the first germs of it were a couple of fans coincidentally wrote at the same time about a character that figures just in a sentence in Heaven's Net is Wide, Otori Takeyoshi, who is the legendary founder of the Otori clan. And there's just about a sentence about him when the boys are talking about heroes. And a couple of fans wrote to me at the same time and said, why don't you write about this guy? He sounds interesting to us. We like the sound of him. And then this is over 5 years ago now. I was in Japan, and I went to visit some friends up in Tohoku in Iwate Prefecture, and they took me to see two forms of dancing, and one is called the Onikenbai, the monster dancing, where they wear amazing costumes, and wasn't the actual dance, but every week they do rehearsals in a local car park, so it was, you know, one of these kind of extraordinary Japanese dichotomies that you have when you're sitting in a car park surrounded by Hondas and Toyotas and so on, and in the centre are these guys, you know, wearing medieval costumes and masks and everything, and you feel as if you're looking back into deep time when you see these dances. And the other one is called the Shishi Odori, which was also being rehearsed, so not at the same place, in a temple garden. And afterwards they very kindly came and posed with us for photographs. And standing next to these young men who were so polite and nicely spoken and everything, and yet when they were dancing they had this extraordinary primitive power, you know, sort of animalistic power that was very impressive. And at that moment I felt that spark that means that you've got the germ of a novel going to happen. And that was where it all came from.
So a nice fusion of the culture you've immersed yourself in and fan interaction sort of prompting you to get into that. No, that's fantastic. So how did you compose the character of Shikanoko? Because I feel he's a very different kind of protagonist to someone like Takeo, who's the protagonist of Tales of the Atori. So what was the process in creating Shikanoko?
It's always hard for me to talk about character because I think it's one of the great mysteries of writing is where characters come from and why they come to life inside your head and why you know them so well and so on. It's not something that I research a lot. I just feel them arrive and I get to know them and I listen to their voice mainly and follow their story. So I guess he starts off as quite a wild young man. He's probably going to be one of those manga bad boys, you know.
A bit of a shonen, by shonen I think the term is, by shonen.
Maybe that's it, yes. And I just liked that element of wildness. I think in Japanese culture there's maybe more acceptance of the wild forces of nature, you know, in that they're inevitable and they're not good or bad. They just happen. It's like, I've forgotten his name, but one of the founder gods, the brother of Amaterasu, I think he's called Sosono, but appears as a sort of typhoon-like figure and is very destructive. But the destruction is also good. Good comes out of destruction as well as bad. And so I guess that I felt that that was the sort of character he was. He can be very destructive, but in a sort of unthinking way, in an animal way. And so the his journey, I suppose, is one of finding out how to use power and how to use it in your own way, not controlled by other people.
And that is definitely, without giving spoilers, his journey definitely takes him in a much more independent direction with his power, and it has both positive and negative consequences as the story goes along. And he's not the only point of view character in your story either. You have, I think, it was probably 10 or 11 different characters who all sort of take centre stage at various points throughout the novel.
Yes.
So was it difficult keeping all those plot lines and all those characters sort of straight in your head? Because there's a lot of, especially later in the book, there's much more of a knock-on effect of one character's plot on another.
I write out the first draft fairly haphazardly without thinking too much about it. So, and the characters appeared to me and I think I need to hear this person's voice now. So I write a section for them. And then I go back and I make a very careful timeline on big sheets of paper of everything that's happened and, you know, what affects who and when it happens and so on. And so I hope to get, you know, that sort of knock-on effect that something happens from one person's viewpoint and the reader realises what the other character doesn't know, that it's going to affect them too, like the storyline in between Masachika and Taka Akira. That has a lot of that going on because of their rivalry.
Without
giving too much away.
Yeah. And that there are quite a few moments where when I was reading, I saw one character do something that then came back a little later and affected another character, but you kind of had to, yeah, read it as, oh, that was this thing that happened earlier, and it sort of was just a little eureka moment every now and then. So there's a nice little surprises throughout the book.
It's often extraordinary how when you write sort of trusting your unconscious and you put in a scene and or an image and you've got not very much idea why it should be there, but you just know that something's told you it should be. And then sometime afterwards, maybe three or four drafts afterwards, I go, ah, that's why that's there. And then I can tie it in with everything else.
All coming together.
Yes.
Oh, wonderful. So was there a reason for setting this prequel specifically 300 years before Otori?
Well, I think I said something about that with Otori Takeyoshi, that was when he lived. So, and that seemed to be a long enough time for it to be in the distant past for the Otori characters, so that it makes sense that we don't hear too much about it during the Otori books. It's sort of lost in the mists of time, as it were.
And there are, it's very much, or I felt it was very much its own story in many ways, and felt, and I've read some of Tales of the Otori, but this didn't feel like a book that was, that the tales were required reading, like it was accessible for somebody who's never stepped into your world.
I think it's a very different book in all sorts of ways, yeah. It's I think it's quite a lot darker in a way, and maybe a bit more demanding on the reader, I don't know. But the other reason was I've always really loved the great medieval warrior tales of Japan, like Tales of the Heikei and the Tale of the Soga Brothers and so on. And they're all set at the end of the 12th or in between the 12th and the 14th centuries. So I guess I was influenced by that after reading them, that I wanted to set something in a similar world.
So you said it was a very different book to Tales of the Otori. Was it then a very different writing process to how Tales of the Otori came about, or was it fairly similar?
I guess it was different in that it went through a lot more drafts. The first three books of Tales of the Otori I wrote up very quickly, and after my first, because I write out by hand in big notebooks, so my second draft is when I type it into the computer. So after my second draft, when it was typed up, those three books had hardly any editing from anybody, so they were kind of very quick and very fresh. And when I read them now, I can see faults in them, but I think that freshness is still there. Whereas this book is a lot more worked. It's been through a lot more drafts. But basically, the writing process is the same. I just sit down every morning, usually starting very early before anyone else is up, and write about maybe 1,000 words a day, sometimes 2,000, never more than that. And then when I've got my 5 or 6 notebooks finished, then I type it up.
That must be a long task, getting that all written from paper to computer. Does it?
Typing it up is kind of tiring, yes.
Mm.
But it's also good because it's taking a new look at it, and it's all, you know, working as a rewrite.
Mm.
I think there's something also to do with the world it's set in, you know, which is totally pre-technology of any sort.
Mm.
And so it feels to be the right pace to be writing like that.
And a little thematically resonant, maybe.
Yeah,
yeah,
I think so.
But what is it that especially appeals to you about the Japanese culture that influences your writing?
It is hard to answer. I mean, there is so much. You know, like, have you been to Japan, or do you know it at all?
I have not, but I would really, really want
it
to go one day.
It is such an amazing country with such an interesting history and culture that it's extremely rich. So it's great. Source, I suppose, of inspiration and writing style and all sorts of things. As to why that should be, I seem to have been interested in Japan all my life, and when I first went there, it felt very strangely familiar to me, like that I have been here before at some stage. And all my Japanese friends say, oh, you were born Japanese in another life. That sort of goes without saying to them. I don't know that I go that far, but there are things about it that I find very familiar, as I said. Also things, of course, that are extraordinary and that shock me every time I go. I'm always finding something new, and I would never dare say, oh, yes, I really understand Japan, because then something else comes out of left field and completely hits you between the eyes, and you think, I don't know anything about this place. I don't understand anything. So as a child, I was always interested, and then so that led me to read a lot of Japanese novels and watch Japanese films and so on. And so when I did go to Japan, first off, I found it all just amazingly interesting. I had the idea for Across the Nightingale Floor on that first visit, but it took me about 10 years to summon up the courage to write it. So.
And when you did, it was very, very clearly informed by that culture, like the roots of it very much seep throughout the story, so it feels quite, in some way, many ways, authentically Japanese.
Well, thank you for saying that. I think that when you immerse yourself in something like that, it's not quite the same as doing research, you know. It's something that is in you, and so when you come to write about it, you just have it all there, you know, not necessarily looking for it in a book or on the internet.
Mm. So would you ever think about writing a fiction or a non-fiction book actually set in Japan, whether historically or contemporarily, like something about the actual country itself?
Well, I've done two historical novels that aren't fantasy at all.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in Yamaguchi Prefecture to start writing Across the Nightingale Floor, I became very interested in the Meiji Restoration, because lots of the young men who started the movement to overthrow the shogun came from that area. So there were still, you know, sort of taverns, were inns where they'd met, and all of their houses are kept, and lots of historical stuff about them. So I decided it would be interesting to try to write something set in that period, which is incredibly complex. Not many people in Australia know an awful lot about it, I don't think. So I wrote a historical novel which ended up being called Blossoms and Shadows, and that was published in 2010. And then I wrote something that follows on slightly after that, 20 years after that, and has one of the characters from that book as one of its main characters, and that's called The Storyteller and His Three Daughters. And I've got an idea that I'd like to write something another 20 years on about the Taisho period, which had a brief flowering of sort of democracy and modernity, a really, really interesting period.
And would you be able to write about that from the women's perspective in there, as you have in your
other work? I probably would,
yeah.
Yes. Yeah, the first historical novel, Blossoms and Shadows, is told in the first person by a woman, and the second one is in the first person by a man, but they both have a lot about women's relationships in them. And I guess I would do this one also from a woman's viewpoint. But the sad thing is that the historical novels haven't done anything like as well as the fantasy novels, so...
I'm sure there's still very much a dedicated audience.
I've had problems getting them published outside Australia.
So the Tale of Shikanoko's sequel, Lord of the Darkwood, is due out in August, I believe, at this
yes.
point. Do you think there might be an idea for another Otori story, either set then or set during contemporary Otori, once Lord of the Darkwood's out? Or
well, I did notice that at the end of Lord of the Darkwood, I give a little synopsis of what happens to various characters.
Okay.
And I kind of left things open for things to happen again, but I don't know. There's a character in Lord of the Darkwood called Takauji, who's only a kind of minor character, but I got really interested in him, and I kind of feel that I might like to write his story.
Can you give us a bit of an idea of who he might be?
He's the son of Takaakura, so he's from the snow country.
And just the last question, do you have a favourite character that you wrote for The Tale of Shikanoko, or maybe a character that you'd like to sit down and have a cup of tea with?
Well, I find all of them really fascinating, I have to say. But it's funny because obviously Shikanoko is my hero, mm-hmm. and he is the character that I suppose I was the most interested in. But the ones I think most about afterwards are the ones who are kind of the anti-heroes, which is Lady Tama, as I said before, and Masachika. And so they're the ones that kind of interest me because they're such flawed characters. But then again, I like Hina very much. She plays much more of a role in Lord of the Darkwood. And the five boys are kind of interesting to me. Mm.
They are certainly intriguing in many ways. All right, well, Leanne Hearn, thank you very much for your time today, and once again, congratulations on the release of Emperor of the Eight Islands.
Well, thanks very much. Thanks for the great questions. I really enjoyed it.
The book Emperor of the Eight Islands, first book of the Tale of Shikanoko, is out today, and Tales of the Otori, there are five books that have also just been recently re-released in very gorgeous new covers.
It's certainly lovely.
So you should be going out and checking those today.
You've been listening to GeekaBuzz Presents Read, Watch, Play. We discussed all things pop culture, including comics, video games, TV, film, and anime.